hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. I'm your host, Brian Freeman, and I'm the author of 14 best-selling psychological thrillers. What we do on this show is help you discover nonfiction storytellers who will be turning the pages the way a great thriller writer does. But of course, every story they tell is absolutely true. My guests today are Michael Leinbach and Jonathan Ward, and they are the authors of Bringing Columbia Home, which tells the story of the Columbia space shuttle disaster in 2003 that took the lives of 7 astronauts. The book takes us behind the scenes on the extraordinary search and recovery effort to find the remains of the shuttle and its crew, and literally piece together the mystery of what brought the shuttle down. This is a very emotional book, as you would expect, but I also found it to be a very uplifting story as well, of coming together in the most trying of circumstances. Mike, Jonathan, welcome to True Story.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for having us on.
You know, Mike, I know that this week marks the 15th anniversary of the Columbia disaster, and you were on the ground at Kennedy Space Center back then, waiting for Columbia to land in Florida. I wonder, can you take us back to that terrible, terrible day and tell us what was going on around you?
Well, yeah, I'd be glad to do that. You know, I was the launch director for the Columbia mission, We had a great 16-day successful mission on orbit, and then we were waiting for the Columbia to come home. In fact, I watched the deorbit burn from my console in the Launch Control Center, and everything went fine. And so we were beside the runway here at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, waiting for Columbia to land. And landing day is always one of just, you know, celebration. We're about ready to welcome our astronauts home, and their families are here waiting for them, and it's just a celebratory day. And so we were standing there waiting for Columbia to land, and she just didn't show up, and it was a very, very empty feeling. I knew Columbia was somewhere between orbit and the Kennedy Space Center, but we had no idea where she was. And once we did that deorbit burn, there was no other place that she could land safely. And so, you know, we knew pretty quickly that it was going to be a bad day, as we say in the space business.
Right, right. Jonathan, there was this terrible silence over in Florida. What was happening on the ground over East Texas?
It was almost exactly the opposite of that silence. And Mike called it very aptly, called it parallel confusion. You know, there was a situation in Florida. They didn't know where the shuttle was, but in East Texas, there was this horrible noise going on and people didn't know what was going on around them. As the shuttle broke up, it was going 12,000 miles an hour, 200,000 feet above the ground. And as those pieces began to encounter the air, the shuttle slowed down. And there were roughly 80 some thousand pieces of the shuttle that were all breaking the sound barrier at the same time. And it created this horrible cacophony, this overlapping series of sonic booms and thunderous explosions that lasted for several minutes. People on the ground, you know, felt their houses shaking, things were rattling on their shelves, the windows were rattling, and people who stepped outside saw smoke trails in the sky and things spiraling through the air and could hear sounds like helicopter blades whizzing as pieces of the shuttle hit the trees and began landing in the ground around them. The shuttle's pieces spent almost half of an hour falling from the sky around them. It was just a horrible time of confusion for people that didn't realize the shuttle was up there.
Yeah, yeah. What was that really impressed me in the book was how you captured that sense of chaos and urgency and emotion in its early hours after the disaster, and how immediately, you know, local and federal agencies and ordinary people just began to pitch in without having any idea of what was going on. And in fact, I made a note early in the book at just to say, look at how fast things are happening. You'd already covered this amazing range of activity of things that were happening on the ground, and yet it was only 90 minutes after.
Yeah, it was one of those situations where, you know, as I talked to everybody, as we were doing the interviews for the book, we talked to about 100 different people who were involved in one way or the other with the accident. And of course, everybody had their own story about where they were when the accident happened. And, you know, it was hard not to create a sense of excitement in those first several minutes there as this chaos was going on. And the real struggle was trying to put it together in a coherent fashion so that people wouldn't get totally confused by what was going on, because there was action in Florida, there was action in Texas, the federal forces were mobilizing, the local forces were mobilizing. But yeah, it was really impressive how fast things happened there in that first couple of hours as all of these forces began converging on the accident scene.
And how did NASA begin to bring some order to this chaos, and what were the priorities in those early hours and early days?
Well, in the early hours, you know, we met in a conference room in the Launch Control Center here at the Kennedy Space Center about an hour after the accident, and we had a contingency plan with us, but it just laid out what to do in sort of general sense, no specifics at all. And so we pulled together the plan in real time here at KFC as the people out in Texas were pulling together a plan to deal with what was happening around them. I recall we were meeting 1 hour after the accident here, not knowing exactly what was going on in Texas, but at that same time, our first astronaut was being found out there on the ground, and so it was a time of emptiness. But we knew we had to get to work and get out to Texas and find our friends. Our first priority, Brian, was to make sure that the debris on the ground that was still smoldering and had toxic materials in it, and even pyrotechnic devices that could explode, that the public knew about those and they knew not to touch them, because we didn't want to hurt anybody on the ground. And so
sure.
Our first priority was the safety of the folks in Texas. The second priority was to find our astronauts, and the third priority was to find the Columbia herself. And that's the way we approached everything for the next 2 weeks or so. And then after 2 weeks were over, the crew was found, and so it got down to just finding the remains of the shuttle itself.
Can you give us some sense of the dimensions of the challenge that you faced in this search and recovery effort? I mean, the vastness of it is what really impressed me.
Well, the first cut at the size of the debris zone was 250 miles long by 20 miles wide. It was in a path. Yeah, I know. It was in a path southeast of Dallas over to the Louisiana border and across the Louisiana border. And then after a couple of 3 days, we narrowed that down, I'll say, to 120 miles long by 10 miles wide. And that's the area that we physically walked, 120 miles long by 10 miles wide, physically walked that over 3 months to find all the debris. And it was the largest ground search ever in American history for anything. And just an enormous effort by so many people that came to our assistance. It really showed America at its best. We didn't ask for help at the beginning. People just showed up and said, you know, what can I do to help you guys?
Yeah, you know, that was so much the overwhelming feel of the book, that this respect that everyone showed for the whole process and the way that the local communities pitched in to help with everything from searching to meals to place to sleep. I love the line that one person said, that their mission became our mission. Can you tell us a little bit about those relationships that were forged on the ground with the locals?
Absolutely. I mean, that was from the very outset. What's one of the things that most impressed NASA was that, the remains of the astronauts that were found over the course of the 12 days that we were searching for the crew, that all of the remains were found by the local townspeople before the official searchers found them. And none of the locals called the news media. None of them, you know, tried to make any kind of name for themselves or profit from this in any way whatsoever. They called the authorities and did the right thing to begin with. So there was a tremendous amount of respect shown to NASA and the families of the astronauts from that standpoint. And these people just said, you know, if this was my kid out there in the woods, I would want the same thing done, you know, for my children as I would for the son and sons and daughters that are these astronauts that are out there now. And it was just one of these things that they could tell that when the NASA folks showed up, who were still shell-shocked from having lost their friends and having lost this beloved vehicle of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
The townspeople embraced them. You know, none of the NASA people, if you had a NASA badge on or a NASA hat on, you couldn't buy a meal in any of those towns. People would buy your meals for you, provide you food in the supermarket. People would do their laundry, would take them in and offer them housing in their houses, because there was just not enough motels around in these small towns to house all the people. So the community completely pitched in and made the NASA people truly feel like family from the very outset.
And there were two people that were actually lost during the search process itself. Is that right?
That's right. One was Charles Krennic from the Texas Forest Service. And the other was Buzz Meyer, who was a pilot who was contracted by the Department of Agriculture Forest Service. They were part of a helicopter crew that was searching for debris. There were five people in the helicopter, and the helicopter was flying at a very low level just above treetops when the fuel pump quit and the helicopter crashed. And Meyer and Krennic were sitting in the front seat, and they were both killed instantly when the helicopter hit the ground. There were two NASA people in the back who both survived, and another Forest Service person who was also injured but also survived as well. So this further cemented the bond between the local community. Krennic was one of the was a local son of the people
right.
there in East Texas, and very very well known throughout the community. And so they truly felt like this had cemented the bond between NASA and the community.
Right, right. Do you have estimate of how many people ultimately were involved in the search process?
You know, we never did a full accounting of how many people or how many agencies, but going back through notes and interviewing people, we think it was on the order of 120 different agencies involved, from federal, state, local, volunteer, you know, different fraternal organizations, all. You know, just any kind of organization you could think of. And then the number of people on the order of 25,000 probably helped us over those 3 months to recover all the debris. And it's really for them that we wrote the book, because their story had never been told before. I mean, there are books out there about the accident itself and the loss of the astronauts, but all the people that helped us, that just came to our assistance and just wanted to do the right thing, their story had never been told before, and that's what really drove the book.
Well, it really was extraordinary, just seeing all the different people from the different agencies, from the local communities that were coming together and you know, sacrificing so much in this process. Yeah, and I think it's easy when you think about the search process. You know, people may sort of leap to the idea of folks, you know, walking across these green meadows looking for debris. But the extraordinary challenges that were involved in the search, I was just making a of some of the things I went along and was coming up with: storms, stump holes, snakes, hail, briars, thorns, and angry bulls, among a lot of others. What was the search really like? I mean, what were some of the challenges that were faced in actually trying to locate debris?
Well, that's, you know, talking to some of the folks from Kennedy who had gone out there as part of the rapid response team that Mike was leading. You know, one of the gentlemen said he'd brought three pairs of jeans with him, and they were completely destroyed within the first 3 days he was out there. They were just shredded by these monstrous briars that are an inch or 2 inches long, or thorns an inch or 2 inches long. He was totally unprepared for the situation. You know, basically his clothes were gone within the first 3 days he was out there. So it became, the mud was awful. One of the great things that the Forest Service did was supply two pair of boots to all of the searchers so that they could wear one dry pair while another pair dried on drying racks in a special tent every day. They supplied chaps for people to protect them from the types of brush that was out there. The creeks were, there were heavy rain. The creeks were swollen. there was mud, there was, as you were saying, hail, there was sleet, there was, some snow. It was just a really rough time out there in the woods. And one of the great things that helped NASA out was that the locals there knew those woods very, very well, and they knew how to protect themselves. One of the Forest Service women told me that she wrapped her uniform in duct tape to protect her from that. That was just one of the tricks she learned when she was going out to work in the deep woods. And that kind of local knowledge was something that NASA couldn't have been prepared for, and so the locals really helped out in that way as well.
You're listening
and
to True
point,
Story.
A point to make.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry, Brian, but a point to make, when we were walking that 120 by 10 mile zone, we couldn't go around anything. We had to go straight ahead. We walked through streams and ponds and mud puddles, and we searched lakes with divers, and so no area within that huge area was left unsearched. It was just an incredible effort by everybody out there.
Extraordinary. You're listening to True Story. This show. Copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Brian Freeman, and my latest thriller is The Voice Inside. I'm talking with Mike Leinbach and Jonathan Ward about their fascinating and emotional new book, Bringing Columbia Home, which is available now from Arcade Publishing. I want to talk a little bit about the astronauts. My wife, Marcia, and I had the honor back in the 1990s to meet and spend some time with Sally Ride when she was giving a speech here in Minnesota. And I remember during the Q&A, someone asked her if she was scared on liftoff. And she said, if you're not scared, you don't understand what is about to happen to you. Obviously, astronauts know and live with the risks they face with every mission, but that does not stop them. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the people and your friends that we lost that day.
Well, the one thing to point out is when the accident happened and so many of the astronauts went up to the debris zone from Houston, I mean, it's only a couple hundred miles away or 150 miles away, whatever it is. And when they interacted with the local folks that were helping us so much, the local people, their impression of the astronauts totally changed. These are real people with real families and real kids, real parents, and they just happen to have an extraordinary job, and they're doing it to advance science and advance technology. But they are real people, and that's the thing that we'd really like to get across, as well as the 25,000 help. Was the astronauts, they do this for a living, yes, but they're also real people. And they just interacted with the locals so well, and they became part of the family. I got to know the astronauts in my job as the launch director, and I always just thought about them on the launch pad before I gave that final go, because I was about to commit them to the most hazardous thing they had ever done. And it is a hazardous job, and they understand
sure.
the risk, but they're willing to take it on behalf of not just our country, but on behalf of the world to advance science and engineering and technology. And they're extraordinary people, but they are real people.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by the level of spirituality in the book, the importance of faith and among so many people of science, both on the shuttle and on the ground. I love the person who said, if people strap 1,000,000 pounds of dynamite to their butts for someone else to light, they'd better have mighty deep faith. Can you talk a little bit about
<That's right>.
That?
Well, I think you'll find that a lot of astronauts are very deeply religious people, and that's, I guess, something that's not too surprising, because a lot of them come from very solid backgrounds, you know, that have been raised with that kind of level of respect, and certainly from the people in East Texas, one of the things I heard repeatedly in talking to the folks out there was that they saw this almost as even starting with Sean O'Keefe, the administrator of NASA, said that the fact that we had 84,000 pieces of the shuttle come down and not a single person on the ground was hurt, he said, is nothing short of divine intervention as far as he's concerned. And when you talk to the people there in Sabine County in eastern Texas, they said they felt that it was that God, you know, had kind of intended for the shuttle to come down there because these were people who could take care of the astronaut family
right.
best. You know, that if this had happened in a more urban area, that perhaps the same level of respect might not have been shown. So again, there's a very deep sense of faith that seems to permeate this whole story.
Yeah, very much so. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the damage to the debris that was covered and how NASA began to approach the problem of figuring out what went wrong?
Well, the debris, we found 38% of the orbiter by weight, and so 62% was lost, and we were kind of estimating on the order of 55% of that vaporized in the atmosphere as it was coming in. There's still some debris out there in East Texas. You know, we had some very massive pumps on the engines for the shuttles, and we had 6 pumps on each shuttle, and we only found 3, so there are 3 of them still out there somewhere. But the pieces range from the size of your thumbnail to the window frames to these large pumps about the size of a beer keg, roughly, and everything in between. There were very few large pieces, frankly, and a lot of tiles came down, and it was mostly burned and scorched and bent, I just remember seeing the debris and remembering what Columbia looked like before the accident, and she was just a beautiful flying machine. And now I saw it in bits and pieces, and it just looked like something out of a junkyard, and that's just not the way a shuttle should look.
Yeah, this was obviously not just a scientific and engineering puzzle. Obviously, this was wrenching emotional for everyone at NASA. How did you folks deal with that?
Well, it was very difficult. I mean, you know. For the people here at the Kennedy Space Center, we felt like we lost, the 8th member of the crew, so to speak, was the orbiter itself. You know, people that worked in the space shuttle program, most of them had worked in the program all their career, and we had people that worked on Columbia, just Columbia, for over 25 years, and you get to the point where you know that vehicle so well. Every bolt, every wire, you begin to love the shuttle as a machine, if that makes sense. And so we were not only dealing with the loss of 7 of our friends, which is totally tragic, we were also dealing with the loss of a machine that we grew to love over the years. We did various things, Brian, in the reconstruction hangar to try to deal with the emotion. But at some point, everybody that worked on it broke down once, twice, sometimes multiple times. And when they did, you just had to let them have their time, let them go outside and gather themselves and come back in and continue the investigation. And it was a combination of a really interesting engineering task, if you could take the emotion out of it,
right.
Which is impossible. But if you
sure.
could take the emotion out, it was a very, very interesting engineering task to piece the shuttle back together and try to figure out what happened. But you could never take the emotion out of it, and so we dealt with it as best we could. And like I say, people broke down frequently, and they still break down. We had a dinner the other night for a few people, and remembering some of the times we had in the hangar, and people still, you know, were on the verge of breaking down. This is 15 years later, so it's very difficult to deal with.
And you were obviously successful in the end in figuring out from a scientific and engineering standpoint what happened and what the problem was. What were some of the lessons that you were able to take away and that NASA was able to take away to get the shuttle program flying again?
Well, you know, there are some classic lessons about having free and open debate about problems, open communications, you know, not being afraid to speak up in large meetings, that type of thing. But really what we got out of it was a sense that we had fallen back into a almost a complacency, overconfidence mode that we were in prior to the Challenger accident back in 86. And so we got better after Challenger, and we kind of fallen back into a complacency, overconfidence mode leading up to Columbia. And then after Columbia, we got better again, and that served us well through the end of the program. We were very, very conscious about having open communications and not being afraid of speaking up. A lot of technical improvement, but those are the minor things. Those are the easy things to fix. The more difficult things to fix are the cultural issues within a large organization that we eroded over time. We got back into a mode very similar to what we were prior to Challenger, and that was disappointing, but it was real, and we addressed that after Columbia, and then fortunately we were very good at it through the end of the program, another 11 years later or so.
Right. Yeah, there are so many wonderful stories in this book. It's hard to pick out just one, but I wonder if you could tell us about the yellow dinosaur.
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the things that was kind of was very touching about the whole recovery is that people would find things. People were asked to look on their property to see if they could find things that related to the shuttle. And somebody turned in one time a bowling ball that had the word Columbia on it. And they said, well, this obviously came from the space shuttle because it says Columbia. So that was turned into the reconstruction hangar, and they still have that. What happened was as they were sifting through material in the reconstruction hangar in the crew module area, somebody pulled out a yellow beat up, torn up old yellow stuffed dinosaur doll, and someone said, well, somebody found this on their property and it didn't belong to them, so obviously somebody must have been carrying this on the shuttle for one of their friends or something. And it became, everybody knew it wasn't the case, but it became kind of an unofficial mascot. As Mike was saying, people were looking for ways to keep the mood light and to try to prop each other up emotionally, and so this yellow dinosaur
sure.
became a mascot. And it got accidentally thrown out one day, by Pam Milroy, the astronaut that was in charge of running the reconstruction in the crew module area, and people sifted through the trash bins frantically and were able to find the dinosaur, and she felt so guilty about that she had a pediatric surgeon friend of hers sew it back up again and make it pristine. And that dinosaur flew into space twice on two subsequent space shuttle missions. It even has its own little badge. I saw it actually in the Columbia room a couple of days ago on display.
Well, I wonder if the family in East Texas that originally owned that dinosaur ever knew what fate went on with that. And now that your book is out, they will learn that their dinosaur became famous, flew up into space. Well, Mike, Jonathan, I really appreciate your taking time to talk with me today. You've written an amazing book, and I recommend it to all of our listeners. But thank you so much for being with me here today.
Our pleasure, Brian.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to do it.
This is Brian Freeman, and you've been listening to True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. Coming up next time on True Story, mark your calendars for next Monday, February 5th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be talking with Lori Gwen Shapiro, author of The Stowaway. It is a wonderful Jack London-style true life adventure about a New York teenager who went to extraordinary lengths to become a part of Commander Richard Byrd's expedition to Antarctica in 1928. And be sure to visit authorsontheair.com for more interviews with best-selling writers in every genre. That's authorsontheair.com. And you can find out more about me, Brian Freeman, at my website, bfreemanbooks.com. Thank you so much for listening, and happy reading.